Well, you had to listen to my oldest boy last week, and now his brother is being imposed on you for just a moment here. Christian is working on his last leader's lesson, and he's going to share it with you all this week, and then we'll get started with the Song of Solomon again. So let's have a word of prayer, and then Christian will come up and share his lesson with us. Will you bow with me, please? Our Father in heaven, we thank you again for continuing to bless us as you always have, for renewing your mercies and allowing us to see the day. We thank you for keeping us to this point and giving us this this space of time for us to be encouraged by one another, to rejoice in one another's presence, to study another portion of your word. We thank you for those who have prepared themselves to lead us in our study today, and for everyone who is present and ready to participate. We also ask you to be with those who are not able to be with us for various reasons. Please bless them and keep them where they are, and allow us to be with them again just as soon as possible. We also ask you to bless Christian as he comes to share his lesson with us, always encouraged by the good things that our young people do. And we look forward to their continued growth and development. In Christ's name. Amen.
Okay.
Sacrificing for others. In Matthew chapter 20, verse 20 through 28, James and John come to ask Jesus to sit at his right hand and his left, because they want to be great in his kingdom. Lots of people want to be great in his kingdom today, but in order to be great in his kingdom, we should listen to what he says. If we want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, we must serve. Serve means to perform duties or acts for another person or organization. People sometimes brag or lie to try to get a bunch of money and for people to call them great. But instead of these things, we should try serving. If we want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, we must become a servant. Serving includes wiping, sweeping, mopping, you know, elbow grease. In Matthew chapter 20, verse 27 through 28, Jesus talks about being crucified by saying, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life a ransom for many. Without his sacrifice, we would all be condemned." In John chapter 19, verse 28 through 30, he is crucified. It reads, "Later, knowing that everything had been finished, and so the scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, 'I am thirsty.' And a jar of wine and vinegar was there, so they soaked it in a sponge on the stalk and put it on the stalk of the hyssop plant and lifted it to Jesus' lips. When he had received the drink, he said, 'It is finished.' And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit." If we want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, we must be willing to do these things. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1 through 2 reads, "Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us, and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God." This verse doesn't mean that we need to crucify ourselves in order to go to heaven. This verse means that we need to be willing to be crucified. If we want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, then why not try to be like the greatest person who ever lived, Jesus Christ? Why not serve as he did? Thank you.
Okay, I think that's what the Bible says. Got to do a little serving. It's good to see y'all. I know it hadn't been that long, but seems like it's been a while. I was out of town for a few days. But now let's shift gears and think about the Song of Solomon again. As best I recall, We left looking at chapter 6 and verse number 9. We did not quite get through all of this. But we were looking at Solomon's second tribute. He had a lengthy tribute to his wife before they married, and then he has this tribute. And if you recall, circumstantially, this one followed on the heels of a spat that the two of them were having. And so she had gone out in search of him after they had a disagreement of sorts, and he is praising her now that they have been reunited. And so I had talked about this triumvirate of praise that he had used. And then he detailed some of the same things that he had talked about previously regarding her beauty and so forth. And we were looking at these verses 8 and 9 where he mentions how unique she is. And so I want to pick up there looking at verses 8 and 9, and then we'll continue on. So in Song of Solomon chapter 6, in verse number 8, he says, "Of her, there are 80 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice of her that bare her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed. Yes, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her." And I think I mentioned before, this helps us to situate the book temporally. We know this is before he had amassed the 700 wives, and so this is at an earlier time in Solomon's life when this particular marriage took place. I believe I would have mentioned this idea about Tirzah was a city in the north, and I talked with you about the fact that that helps us also to place the book in time, because this was not a great city comparable to Jerusalem after the nation of Israel had been destroyed and taken over by these foreign powers, the Assyrians and so forth. It would not have been a great city at that time. And so this allusion that he makes to Jerusalem on the one hand in the south and Tirzah in the north, it would be nonsensical unless this was written during the time that the book says it is written, that is during the days of Solomon. So let's go ahead now and look at verses 10 through 13 and finish up this chapter, and then dive into chapter 7. In verse number 10, "Who is she that looks forth as the mornings, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? I went down into the garden of nuts to see the green plants of the valley, to see whether the vine budded and the pomegranates were in flower. Before I was aware, my soul set me among the chariots of my princely people. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon thee. Why will you look upon the Shulamite as upon the dance of Mahanaim?" Now, this passage has a couple of interesting things to it. You know, when you look at the commentators, people really kind of struggle sometimes to determine who is doing the speaking in this particular part and what some of these allusions are about. I would suggest to you that it seems most natural that Solomon is the person who is speaking. There's no indication of a change in speaker here in the text. And so then you really kind of have to force something onto the text to suggest there is a change between these persons. It's not the kind of thing I'd argue with someone about, but I think that's the most natural way to read this. So he is in the midst of praising her, and he has talked about her beauty and so forth. And in verse number 10, he says something else. He talks about what I call her radiance. You can see that he uses these four allusions to her being a radiant woman. He talks about her looking forth as the mornings, that is the dawn. He talks about the moon, and then he talks about the sun. And then he has this reference to being terrible as an army with banners. And we talked about this last week. The idea of an army is not there, but it is the word. The word refers to banners. I read, and I just thought it interesting. I don't know exactly what that would refer to in this context, but when you see all these celestial references, at least one source I looked at said this could be a reference to the stars. Those would be the banners of the sky. It could make some sense. Won't try to press that. But the message is very clear, isn't it? His point is that he has these various queens, he has these various concubines, he has, he says, virgins without numbers, but she outshines them all. She is unique. She is unique in his palace. She is unique in his heart as well. And that's the point of verse number 10. In verse 11, Again, some people suggest that there's a change in speakers here, but I continue on with the thought that this is Solomon still speaking. He seems to confirm that she was correct. You remember the daughters of Jerusalem had asked the question, well, where is he so that we can help you find him? And she says, well, he's gone down to his garden. Now they've been reunited. He has praised her and so forth. And then he seems to, I believe, affirm that she was right. She knew where he was and how to find him. And so in verse number 11, he says, I did go down to my garden. I went down there to check on the plants and so forth. This is something that he seems to have enjoyed, and she knew that about him. Verse 12, this is still his tribute to her. Verse 12, I think, is a little more difficult to be certain about. Before I was aware, my soul set me among the chariots of my princely people. Now, on the surface, it seems pretty clear what's being said there. He says, I was sort of almost surprised, but I wound up being on these chariots, or among these chariots, and among my people. But it doesn't tell us what he was unaware of, before he was aware of what in particular. Lots of ideas about that. I tend to think the simplest meaning is the one that is actually appropriate here. You remember the circumstances. He was trying to go in and spend some time with his bride, and she was not in a hurry to get up and let him in. You'll remember she said, well, you know, I've washed my feet already. I'm in the bed here. I've taken my clothes off, you know. And by the time she made her mind up to get up, and by the time she sort of tried to make herself presentable with the myrrh and all of this, well, by the time she did that, Solomon, she couldn't find him. Question, why couldn't she find him when she knew he was in his garden? That's where she said she thought he was, and it turns out that is where he was. So why couldn't she find him? It seems to me that when he left, maybe he didn't go directly to his garden, but he went walking. He sort of went maybe to blow off some steam would be, the way we might say that today. But he was bothered by what has taken place, and he sort of went walking aimlessly. He's just sort of meandering about, and he says, you know, before I knew it, I was among these chariots and among the people of Israel. He wound up sort of in a crowded situation, not intending to do that, but just sort of walking aimlessly, and ultimately made his way down to the garden. Now, it doesn't say all of that, but I'm sort of putting two and two together. I think that's probably the simplest. He says he went sort of aimlessly walking and wound up in a place almost unawares. And I think that seems to fit the context. But if you want to wrestle with it more than that, I leave it to you. Verse 13. Now we've got a group speaking again. This is the return, O Shulamite. We know it's a group because they say, return that we may look upon you. So it's not the wife who's speaking, obviously. This doesn't seem to be Solomon because he's referring to a group. Perhaps it's possible he could be part of the group. But I think it might refer to these daughters of Jerusalem. They've been very much involved. You remember at the end of the previous chapter, she speaks to them and invites them to participate in the search and so forth. And I think it would make some sense if they are the ones who are asking her to return at this point. Solomon has given this great tribute to her, and now they want to see her. She apparently was there, and they would like her to come again. They say, return, return. There is some suggestion in some places that this is part of the wedding celebration. I think that would be out of context. We've already concluded the wedding. We're into the marriage now. So I think that's likely what's going on into the text. Otherwise, we're introducing another group that hasn't been a part of the text heretofore. Questions or thoughts about that? I know we sort of are finishing up our thoughts from last class here, but this is the section of his tribute. This is his second tribute to his wife. They've been reunited now after their marital difficulties. Questions or thoughts about this? All right, then I make an observation. I try to intersperse some applications as we go through the book. I think it's a very practical book in a lot of ways. I want you to think about this. Those of you who are married, Ever have any spats in your marriage? Ever have any disagreements? She ever do anything to make you upset? Now, Bob, I know you can't really say right now, but she ever say anything to make you upset? Does Bob ever move a little too slow for you or something? I mean, this is what happens, right? This is what happens. What I think is interesting is how they handled this. Solomon, I'm sure he felt as if he had been wronged by his wife. She seems to have felt that she was in the wrong. She repented and got up and changed her behavior, which would suggest that she thought in some way her behavior was inappropriate. But once they were reunited, they didn't even seem to speak about it. He's gone walking. Maybe he's blowing off some steam. He's gone down into the garden. Maybe he wants to be by himself. She's been looking for him and having trouble finding him. And when she finally makes it to him, I noticed that Solomon doesn't say anything about what has taken place, but they move straight into a mode of reconciliation. And he praises her. Listen to this. He praises her after this dispute in the same way that he praised her on the day they were married. I think that's quite remarkable. You know, on their wedding day, you can say, well, I see how he'd say some nice flowery things on her wedding day, but maybe, you know, within a matter of a few hours after they had a dispute, I think it remarkable that he had that kind of mind, that he would speak about her in this kind of way. And I ask myself, and I ask you, I mean, how was he able to have this kind of disposition? How was he able to have this kind of disposition to his wife, who had just wronged him a short time before this? How was he able? This one's not rhetorical. I'm not going to answer it for you. How was he able? He was at least that wise. Yeah, well, I guess he could have been minded to bear a grudge, you know. He could have been minded to, you know, rehearse everything that happened, but maybe he just saw that there was no need. I mean, she obviously felt badly about what has taken place, and he perceived that. And if we're going to sort of keep a tally every time something doesn't go quite right, it's going to make things a little less pleasant, isn't it? Sometimes, isn't it easier to just, you know, things happen, let's just kiss and make up without going through all of the gory details. And sometimes, of course, you have to go through the details, but maybe if a slight thing, maybe you just don't have to. Maybe we don't have to keep score. Maybe we don't have to keep score. Say again. Well, I think that's right. He sees her disposition, right? He sees that she's penitent already. So if I think that you kind of already get it, then maybe there's nothing really for me to say, right? If it already seems obvious to me that you're sorry, then I don't need to browbeat you about it. Well, that's right. She worked pretty hard, didn't she? Well, she got more than stopped, didn't she? She got beat up a little bit. She got roughed up. It's just something to think about. Because you're going to have things like this happen in your marriage, and sometimes we can move straight to just kissing and making up and praising one another. Yes, sir. Well, Solomon had all of these wives, and so he certainly would have had some previous experience with things like this. You know, I sometimes say, we certainly don't want to follow his example, but if anyone knew a little something about a wife, Solomon, he should know a little something, right? Because he's not working on just the one wife that he has to study and know. He didn't happen to have a PhD in the one wife. He had more experience than 700 of us maybe will have all put together. So hopefully he did learn something from all of that. But Okay, so that's just something to think about, I believe, from that particular chapter. Now let's look at chapter 7, verses 1 through 9 here. Now we won't, I'll try not to drag this out because this is his third tribute, and the third tribute comes right on the heels of his second tribute, but I do want to point out a few things about it. So let's look at chapter 7, verses 1 through 9. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter! Thy rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. Thy body is like a round goblet, wherein no mingled wine is wanting. Thy waist is like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Thy two breasts are like two fawns, they are twins of a roe. Thy neck is like the tower of ivory. Thine eyes are as the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath-Rabim. Thy nose is like the tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. Thy head upon thee is like Carmel, and the hair of thy head is like purple. The king is held captive in the tresses thereof. How fair and how pleasant art thou, O love, for delights. This thy stature is like to a palm tree, and thy breast to its clusters. I said, I will climb up into the palm tree. I will take hold of the branches thereof. Let thy breast be as clusters of the vine, and the smell of thy breath like apples, and my mouth like the best wine, thy mouth like the best wine that goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding through the lips of those that are asleep. So this is his third tribute to her. Obviously, he talks about her beauty again in some great detail. In the previous occasions, he didn't go into quite as extensive of a description because here he goes literally from head to toe. I mean, he goes from her feet all the way to the hair of her head. So he goes all the way up and down her body. And without dragging this out, you'll notice he talks about these specifics again. He always is quite specific. He talks about her feet and her thighs. He talks about her body and her waist, her breasts, her neck, eyes, and nose, head and hair, her stature, her breath, her mouth, and her lips. So he has paid very close attention to all of this, and he has very specific things to say about it. And of course, some of these allusions that he makes, they're somewhat lost on us today. I don't know how many ladies would like to be told, you know, their waist is like a heap of wheat. It just may not sound quite as flattering, but obviously in his day and in his time, it was. He says, you know, just some of the things that maybe don't translate as well today. He says her nose is like a tower of Lebanon. Well, I just don't know any person that wants to be told that their noses remind someone of a tower. Like, it's probably not going to work today. So, gentlemen, I continue to encourage you to update your compliments, okay? You got to find something a little more modern than this. And ladies, I encourage you to indulge these men as they try. But he makes all of these references to her. This one stands out from the others in that it is his intentions in terms of having intimate relations and being very sensual are much more clear. It's not just that he is complimenting her for the sake of complimenting her. He is complimenting her in this case with a clear design. And you can see that in verses 8 and 9 when he says, now he extends this metaphor here. Because in verse 7 he says, her stature is like a palm tree. So he said, listen, your body is like a palm tree to me. And then he says in verse 8, I will climb up into the palm tree. I will take hold of the branches thereof. Let your breasts be as clusters of the vine and the smell of thy breath like apples. He's talking about the fruit of the tree now. So this is all very sensual. It's not just your body. I like the appearance of it. He's saying I want to experience it here. And so that makes this a bit different than the others. Questions or thoughts about it? Questions or thoughts about this? All right. Well, then let's see if we can move into her response then. Her response goes through the rest of this chapter, these last few verses in the chapter, and the beginning of the next. So let's read this material together. We'll begin in chapter 7 and verse 10 and read down through chapter 8 and verse 4. And I think that's as far as we'll go today, but this is all one unit of material. In verse 10, She says, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine has budded and its blossom is open and the pomegranates are in flower. There will I give thee my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and at our doors are all manner of precious fruits, new and old, which I have laid up for thee, O my beloved. O that thou wert as my brother that sucked the breasts of my mother. When I should feed thee without, I would kiss thee. Yes, and none would despise me. I would lead thee and bring thee into my mother's house, who would instruct me. I would cause thee to drink of spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand should be under my head, and his right hand should embrace me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake my love until he please. Now that refrain, we've talked about that before, this idea of making that a gender-specific term, my love, he please, that it would actually be properly rendered, stir not up love till it please, not a masculine term there, gender-neutral term. So let's take a look at this. Now he's gone through and rehearsed how much he's impressed by her body and how much he's thinking about that and how much he would like to take some action in regard to that. And then let's see how she responds. In verse number 10, she repeats her refrain that she belongs to him. And then she says, his desire is toward me. And you'll recall, we have seen this phrase that I am my beloved's now three times here. It's changed a little because in chapter 2 and verse 16, she said, my beloved is mine and I am his, okay? And then in chapter 6 and verse number 3, she says the same way, I am my beloved and my beloved is mine. So she's talking about the mutuality here. But in this context, he has expressed his desire for her and then she just says, I belong to him. Okay, very good. His desire is toward me. So he has these strong longings and desires for her, and she welcomes that. She appreciates that. Now, in the next couple of verses, in 11 and 12, the beginning part, she says, listen, these are the various places that we can go. And she's a lady who's accustomed to working out in the field and so forth, and he obviously is very much impressed with nature and all of that, makes all these references to his garden and so forth. And so she makes some suggestions about places that they can go so that they could be private. But not only private, at the end of verse number 12, she makes it clear that she has an intention to be intimate. She says, I will give my love to you. So he's expressed his desire to be with her. And she says, listen, I love that. I love that that's what you want. I've got suggestions about where we can go, and I intend to be with you. I intend to satisfy you in this regard. She says something else that's interesting in the context. In verse number 13, she says that he is not the only one who has been waiting. You see, she says here, and at our doors are all manner of precious fruits, new and old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. I believe that is a reference to her desire to be intimate with him as well. So, this idea of mandrakes, you guys remember, there's only one time I can recall that mandrakes are mentioned in the Bible. You guys remember what was going on there? Okay, Rachel and Leah, and they struck a bargain, you know, because, of course, Jacob's got to divide his time between all these various wives, and Leah says, listen, I've bought your time this evening, so. And Reuben, I believe it was, had gone out to get mandrakes from the field for her. And the idea, largely based on that verse, the idea seems to be that mandrakes were associated with fertility for sure, because that's what she was interested in, but also maybe an aphrodisiac. You can see in this verse here, yeah, see, the mandrakes give forth their fragrance. And so there's obviously some smell, some scents associated with it. And I don't know if they would ingest the mandrakes or not, but there was some association with fertility. I have a book in my library called All the Plants of the Bible. And this I take from that book because this is outside of my my bailiwick. But it tells me that the mandrake is a part of the potato family. And it tells me, it talks all about the leaves and so forth, how they grow and all of this. But it also says that the smell may be a fairly pungent smell. Very, very strong, but not one that we would all consider pleasant. I just think that's interesting information. So when she says that the mandrake gives its fragrance, for them, perhaps, that was something that would be associated with intimacy and aphrodisiac and that kind of thing. It's not the kind of smell that someone would miss. So when she says that it gives its fragrance, that was potentially pretty meaningful or significant. I want you to notice something here by way of application. Now, as we read through the book, there's obviously some strong interest that the husband and wife here have for one another physically. And quite appropriate in the context that they would. But one of the things that I notice here is that their passion for each other does not wane after the marriage. Now, we would say, or after that they got married, after the ceremony, the honeymoon. You know, it's probably pretty easy for us to imagine that, well, leading up to the wedding, you know, all that is built up to the ceremony and the honeymoon, okay, well, it makes sense for us that before they were married, they had this kind of passionate desire for each other. And also we can say, well, the honeymoon, the consummation of the wedding, sure, of course, they had this kind of passion and desire for one another. But isn't it interesting that it doesn't seem to have waned one bit after the honeymoon? I don't know that that is typical. I don't know that that's typical. I tend to doubt that it's atypical. Solomon's desires for his wife were strong. They were quite strong. And they were expressed. But I want you to notice they were welcomed and they were requited as well. I told you when we first started to look at this book that one of my students, when I taught this book, I taught the wisdom literature at the Southeast Institute of Biblical Studies in Knoxville to some of the preaching students there. And I told you that one of the students, he just said, boy, I just have a really hard time understanding why this book is here. Well, friends, this book in so many ways helps us to see how this aspect of marriage is supposed to be. The passion that husbands and wives are supposed to have for one another in the context of the marriage relationship. And you see how the world has perverted this so. You see how the world has simply abused the idea of sensuality and all of that. And you see how people just completely disregard the context for it. Well, when they do that, they make something that God has made a great thing. They take something that God has blessed, and they make it something tawdry and something low and something to be ashamed of. But I see in this material here that is not the way that God designed it. And I encourage all of us in that regard. Don't take these things for granted. Don't take these things for granted. This is a vital part of marriage. It's the way God intended marriage. It's a big part of the way God intended for marriage to function. So let's not disregard it. Let's not do that. If we go to chapter 8, this part here is interesting because she says to him something that we would have a hard time getting next to, I believe, today. She says she wishes that he were as her brother. And then she talks about the idea of him being not just like an adopted brother, but she talks about him being nursed by her mother and so forth. And, of course, that's a little bit lost on us, but I think the idea is that she desired that they had always been together. She desires that they had always been with one another, that they had grown up together, and so they had spent their lives together, not just at this point in time, now they get to spend their lives together, but she's saying, I wish we had always been together. And one of the reasons that this seems to be the case is that she feels inhibited in terms of her ability to display her affection for him publicly. Right? There's some things that just wouldn't be appropriate in the company of other people. And that seems to be pretty clear, because in verse 1 she says, when I should find thee without, when I see you out and about, I would kiss you, yes, and none would despise me. So clearly she's suggesting that if at this point, if she were to see him out and want to have these public displays of affection and so forth, some would have a visceral or a negative reaction to that. And so she feels somewhat constrained. She has a desire for these public displays of affection in that regard. She goes on, though, and says, I would lead you and bring you into my mother's house. Who would instruct me? I would cause you to drink of spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand should be under my head, and his right hand should embrace me. That could refer to her desire to be intimate with him. She says, I take you to my mother's house where they could potentially be in private. Suppose that's the idea there. But she feels somewhat inhibited. And, of course, there are properly inhibitions on public displays of affection. There's obviously some limits to that. But now I told you, I said this a couple of weeks ago, and I did not mean it to be in jest. I don't mean it to be in jest. You know, listen, husband and wives shouldn't necessarily look like brothers and sisters, okay? I mean, it's okay to hold hands. It's okay to hug. It's okay to kiss, okay? This is good. But, of course, there are limits. And we just live in a society where all of the limits, all of the yield and the stop signs are blown through, and people think that there are no limits, okay? There certainly are. And she seems to recognize that there is a proper decorum for all of this. And would that more people recognize the proper limits on this kind of thing today. Maybe then our televisions wouldn't look like they do, right? Maybe then our advertising wouldn't look like it does. People have simply lost their minds and don't remember that some things don't belong in the public sphere anymore. Questions or thoughts about it? That's where we're going to stop today, because we've got 2 or 3 minutes and no reason to open up the rest of the chapter. We'll finish the rest of the chapter when we're together again. Questions or thoughts about any of this? You guys tracking with me on the book? Does it seem to make some sense? Am I convoluting it for you? Is it making some sense? You just keep looking at me, right? Nobody say anything. Just keep looking at me. Yes, ma'am. I think that's probably right. Well, and the comment there, if you didn't hear it, is that some people probably demean or diminish the value of marriage to sort of make themselves feel better about their circumstances. And I think that there's probably some merit to that. But, you know, and I won't dissolve into a whole long thing about this, but, you know, people don't like to have any constraints anymore. And marriage is a tremendous blessing. But marriage comes with constraints. And what people many times would prefer is to have all of the blessings of marriage and none of the burdens. And so you see people imitating marriage, but they try to imitate it in a way that doesn't come with any burden at all. They want all of the pleasures of marriage, but they don't want any of the pain. And so they try to imitate marriage in a way that allows them to experience all the pleasures and none of the pain. I mean, why bother living together? Why bother? Okay, because there is something good about a man and a woman cohabitating in that way. Okay, but if you're going to cohabitate, why not get married? Because there are responsibilities and there are duties and there is accountability, and people don't want that. So they say, well, we'll just take the pleasure without any of the pain. Yes, sir. People approach marriage like two fleas on a dog. Just want what they can get out of it. Sad commentary, but it's true a lot of times, isn't it? Thank you for your time. Listen, next week I'm going to be away again. I forget who, but we're going to have a substitute teacher in here. And when I come back the next week, we'll finish up this book. Thank you.